This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the history of women in space. We'll talk about the first women to aspire to be astronauts and the women who have followed. Our guest is historian Betty Ann Holtzman-Kevlis. She is the author of Almost Heaven, The Story of Women in Space. Kevlis was living in Pasadena, California, when she began writing about science. And there in Pasadena, she was a stone's throw from the California Institute of Technology and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And she noticed the growing number of women in the sciences and in engineering. Then in 1983, she was among those cheering as Sally Ride became the first American woman to orbit the Earth. Other American women followed Ride, and in 1999, a woman, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Eileen Collins, was in command of a mission. Kevlis was curious about these astronauts. She wondered what had motivated these women. She wanted to know how they were able to achieve their goals, and she wanted to know if they had changed NASA, and if so, how. Good questions all, and those are some of the questions we'll take up with Betty Ann Holtzman-Kevlis this afternoon. Listeners, I hope you'll join the discussion with your questions. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Betty Ann Holtzman-Kevlis teaches in the Department of History at Yale University. She recently held the Charles Lindbergh Chair at the National Air and Space Museum. Her book, Almost Heaven, is available in paperback from the MIT Press. She joins us this afternoon from Yale. Good afternoon and welcome.
Good afternoon to you.
It's so nice to talk with you. This is a very good read, and it is a fascinating history.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
How many astronauts are in the NASA astronaut corps, and how many are women?
Well, I'm not sure what the numbers are now. I think they're around 120, and around 40 are women. Maybe fewer, maybe now maybe 35.
Yeah. Significant number, nonetheless.
Oh, yes. It's once they decided to take women, they went out of their way to take six for the first group that took women. So it wouldn't just be, you know, your single, you know, nominal woman.
Mm. What was life like there for those first six?
I think life was very exciting for them. They were all very different women. All but one had never dreamed of being an astronaut because there had been no women astronauts. One, however, Ray Seddon, who is a doctor, had wanted to be an astronaut as long as she wanted to be a doctor. So she figured that when they took women, they would need a doctor. And she took flying lessons. She did everything she could so that when the call came, which was in 1978, she was there, you know, ready to fill out her application. But the others had no idea about it because there was no, it hadn't been a possibility before.
Yeah. Long before Sally Ride, there were American women, though, who dreamed of becoming astronauts. And in 1960, a group of 26 were selected for testing to see if they might be able to withstand the rigors of space flight. Would you give us some sense of who those women were and why they wanted to go into space?
Well, here we have the first group of astronauts were selected in 1959, and we know them as the Mercury 7. And they chose, they were all from the military, and they all had some kind of advanced training in engineering. And a lot of attention was given to them. They were, eventually there was a deal made with Life magazine, but their lives were chronicled. And it seemed very exciting, the idea of going into space. And we knew then, Americans knew that the Soviets were also having a space program. So we were all in this adventure together. And so there were several space, what do you call them, doctors who worked with the, at that time, the aviation agency to test men to see how strong they were and how able they were to fly at very high altitudes. And one of these people had a clinic in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the actual selection of the male astronauts was outsourced to this clinic because it was you wouldn't have been able to get volunteers among professional aviators within the military because they didn't want it on their records in case they didn't turn out to be first rate. So the man who owned the laboratory, the clinic in New Mexico, whose name was Randy Lovelace, thought it'd be interesting to test women. And so he was just talking about it with a friend during an aviation meeting in Florida. And he said, well, you know, maybe it would be good to test women. And then they happened to bump into a woman who was walking along, and they asked her if she would consider the idea of being an astronaut. And she kind of liked the idea. And she said, well, she would, you know, be willing to go through all these tests. She was a flyer. She had never flown in a jet because women were not allowed to fly in jets because jets were all in the military. And there hadn't been any military women in the military officially in the military Air Force ever. During World War II, there had been some women who flew unofficially, and they were not recognized for their contribution until many years later when Senator Goldwater had them retroactively acknowledged for their work. So this was the way it was back in the early 60s. But these women, this woman really wanted to fly, and she was willing to go through all these tests. So she did, and then she was asked, well, since she did so well, why not help them choose some other women? And so she went to a group called the 99s, which is a group of women aviators, which is still thriving. And she went over these lists, and she chose with Mr. Lovelace other women who might be candidates. And so they contacted 26 of these women, and 12 of the others succeeded in all these tests. And so they were told, well, then they it might be able to go to the Air Force Base at Pensacola, Florida, and actually fly jets. Now, the first woman was Jerry Cobb, and she had won all sorts of prizes for her flying. And she was also the first test pilot at an airplane manufacturer in Oklahoma. However, she had never flown a jet, and she had no advanced education in terms of plain old academic education. Most of the women who tried out for this were aviators. They were excellent flyers, but they had none of the additional training that the men who became members of the astronaut corps had, because they just had never had the opportunity to fly jets, and they didn't have training as engineers. Yeah. They were flyers.
So de facto, then, they're shut out because of this requirement that you've got to have experience as a jet test pilot.
Well, they were also shut out because they didn't have the formal education. But they had never really been considered. This idea of testing them was Lovelace's idea. NASA had nothing to do with it. So when the people in Pensacola, which asked NASA if they were going to pay for all these tests, NASA said no. Because it had never been part of their program, their plan. It had been beyond their imagination, actually, the men at NASA, to even consider having women astronauts.
Were they interested?
So the women were actually fooled by the people in at Albuquerque. But they were willing to take the chance because perhaps NASA would have changed their mind.
Yeah. And maybe someday in the future, if it wasn't them, perhaps they could. This information could be used to make the case for women in space.
That's true. And Jerry Cobb kept trying to get attention, and she made a pretty good case when John Glenn was sent up in, I think it was 99, and he said he was going up for a real ride in space rather than just a trip around the Earth on the shuttle because he was older. And she said, well, you have an older man. Why don't you take me? I'm an older woman. And her senator thought she should go, and a lot of people thought she should go. But by this time, NASA just wouldn't consider her. She had been a thorn in their side for a long time, always getting attention, saying, well, what about women?
Yeah. Yeah. These women, it must have been just, I can see why you'd have a thorn, why you'd be a thorn in the side of NASA after what they went through. After the Loveless tests, a couple of years passed, and a paper was published that really dismissed women. It's unbelievable to read it, even though I know that some time ago this was kind of the way people thought, that women's physiology was just notoriously unreliable. And if I might quote from your book, in support of their claim, they noted that there were studies unspecified showing that women who are menstruating or near menstruation are inattentive and accident-prone. Moreover, at such times, they might experience a change in peripheral vision, especially if the woman were taking the new and threatening birth control pill. And in a reference to word-of-mouth information from someone at the Civil Aeronautics Administration, they added that it was common knowledge that in the days surrounding menstruation, women are often mentally ill and prone to suicide or crime.
Well, of course, there was no evidence for that.
Right.
This was word-of-mouth. But it was one way in which the hierarchy at NASA decided to dismiss the possibility of women altogether.
Hmm. How long did this kind of thinking prevail?
Oh, I think it probably prevails in some places today.
Mm.
This was when they finally did have women, and they were sending up the Sally Ride. No one who was actually at the Kennedy Space Center who was actually preparing the flight. The men didn't who were doing it didn't have the courage to ask Sally what if she would be menstruating. Some of the women were taking the birth control pill, some weren't. But they didn't have it was still an inhibited period of time. They could not ask her, and they thought, well, maybe she would be. Who knew? And so they decided to prepare her with tampons. They stored a whole lot of them, but they didn't know how many a woman might need for 4 or 5 days, so they stored around 100. And then they did have the foresight to tie them all together like sausages so that if she needed them and opened them up, they wouldn't fly all over the shuttle but would be tied together like a string. Hmm. But it was a time when men and women did not talk about menstruation casually. It was an embarrassment.
Yeah. In the first chapter, you make some important observations about NASA. It is part of the legacy of the Cold War, and while set up as a civilian agency, many of its early leaders were military men. How does this affect the story of the struggle of women to become astronauts?
Well, NASA is still largely military. That is, most of the astronauts have gone through the military in some way. After Challenger, they turned to the military more than before, just because they were. It seemed that military people knew how to respond better to a crisis. So it has been. NASA has operated. The astronaut corps has operated in a military model with top-down authority, which passes down to the person who has to obey at the bottom. And NASA has supposed to have had a totally civilian mission. And in general, up until recently, this was accepted. And the only military missions that NASA has had, and they have taken lots of military payloads, they were all observational payloads, spy satellites, but that was the extent of the military involvement.
Why were the Soviets open to the idea of women in space?
The Soviets had a very different attitude towards the space program. First of all, they didn't count pennies. I mean, we are a society where the bottom line, the budget is very important. The Soviets probably never had a budget. They were kind of oblivious to what things cost because everything was so basically corrupt, and people paid for what they wanted to pay for, and that you shuffle things from different part of the organization to another. They also had a very romantic idea about space, which is much more romantic than Americans. The Soviets were, or the Russians at the time in the early 20th century, had been writing science fiction. There had been a mathematician named Tsiolkovsky who figured out exactly how much force you would need to send up a rocket to go into space and maybe go to the moon. And this had been part of the Soviet-Russian worldview for a long time. And so once they were able to travel in space, of course, it was part of the Cold War. There was a competitive edge to this. But on shuttle flights or their own earlier space stations, they would have a lot of time that wasn't particularly organized. And most of the early Soviet astronauts wrote poetry and painted. It was a very different society that was producing these people. Hmm. So it's hard to compare.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit about a fellow by the name of Sergei Korolev and how he saw Russia, the Soviets, in space. What was his dream, his vision?
Well, he was the single person, kind of like our von Braun, but von Braun was not the only. Von Braun, of course, was a German immigrant who had built rockets for the Germans during World War II, and he met in America with other people interested in rockets who were homegrown Americans who just wanted to put rockets into space. Korolev was the single person who survived the purges of the 1930s. He'd always been interested in rocketry. He wasn't particularly interested in warheads, but he knew that if he was going to get money and power to make rockets, he would have to do something that would please the leaders. And so he put up the very first Soviet ship into orbit, which was in 1957, which was simply a single sphere that orbited the Earth. This was Sputnik. Mm-hmm. And then he put in, after Sputnik 1, there was Sputnik 2, and then he sent up some dogs. And it was his dream that there would be families in space. So he was eager to send up a woman, and the sixth Soviet flight took a woman, Valentina Tereshkova, into orbit. And he figured, well, there would be women, there would be men, there would be children, there would be whole families. I think he figured that in 20 years, the whole space between the Earth and the Moon would be just filled with orbiting satellites filled with people. But he didn't live very long. He died in, I think it was 1966, from, a botched operation. But anyway, he died. And his dream kind of died with him.
Hmm. Interesting. This is The Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon is Betty Ann Holtzman-Kevelis. She is the author of Almost Heaven, The Story of Women in Space. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The first woman in space, tell us about her, Valentina Tereshkova.
Well, she was the dream of Khrushchev come to life. She was a woman who came from a very poor family, had had a hard time as a child during World War II, had an education that was a rustic rural education. But she had been head of her youth group, the communist youth group, and was a brilliant public speaker. And she was also a great parachutist. Parachuting was a major athletic hobby in the Soviet Union in the late 50s and early 60s. And so when the Russians had thought that they would find themselves a woman cosmonaut, they looked to the parachute clubs. And they asked around other places, but mostly they had gotten thousands of women writing letters after Gagarin had his first flight saying, well, of course you're going to need to send up a woman, and all of these various people volunteered, thousands of them. So they culled their letters, and they looked at the parachute clubs, and they had a class of around five women who they sent through to be trained to be cosmonauts. And it wasn't certain before the flight whether it would be this Valentina, Tereshkova, or another Valentina, Ponomareva, who had actually been a flyer, but she wasn't as personable as Tereshkova, and she was married with a 4-year-old. And according to what people said in Russia, that in those days, maybe even today, There was kind of a feeling that women who are mothers should be revered, and that it would be terrible to send up a mother who might be killed, leaving an orphan. Mm-hmm. So Tereshkova won by, I wouldn't quite say by default, because she was the most charming person. She was, in a way, a female Gagarin, poor peasant family, was the epitome of what the communists wanted to show the world, that someone could go from the very bottom of society up literally into the heights of space because the Russians were open to social mobility.
Yeah. And, you know, this was interesting to me, that her trajectory as an astronaut was not a cakewalk. How did she fare on her flight, and what was her life like back at Star City, at the headquarters of the Soviet program Star City, following her flight?
Well, it's hard to know exactly. On the flight, she got a little, she wasn't feeling too well. She at first thought she wasn't eating. They knew what she was eating, and then she managed to eat a little bit more. They suggested sending her back after 2 days, and she said no, she wanted to do the whole planned flight. When she landed, there was a big crack in the way the Soviets did it was that they parachuted out of the craft because it was always a hard landing. We always landed our astronauts into the water, mm-hmm. for the first 10 years, and they parachuted onto land, but she had the ship followed her, which was a capsule, and it had a crack in the front glass where they would look out, and no one knew how it had happened, and no one knew. She landed in the middle of nowhere, because they couldn't really guide the capsule at that point. And she was met by a lot of peasants who came out to see her. And she took the food that she had with her and distributed it to everybody. So when she was finally met by the official team, they couldn't tell how much food she'd actually eaten, which they wanted to know for purposes of further flights. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know how this front window had cracked. Months later, she mentioned that she was trying to take a film cassette out of its holder and had struck the window, and that had cracked it. But she didn't tell them for a long time. And the other cosmonauts, the men in Star City and the group who were the administrators, hated her. They felt that she had gotten sick. and she was showing weakness by being nauseated at one point, and here she had lied about the broken window, and she'd given away her food, and she wasn't professional, and they really despised her. However, before going into space, all of the women in this group had been promoted into being part of the Air Force, and you can't be fired from the Air Force. So she stayed at Star City, as did the other women who had not had a chance to go into space, who were promised that they would have a turn soon, but that soon never happened. Over the years, she became, her position changed. She turned out to be disliked in Star City, but adored throughout the rest of the country. She was greeted with ticker tape or the equivalent parades in Moscow. She was sent around the world and spoke in just about every capital. And she was a wonderful speaker. She is a wonderful speaker. She is still alive and healthy. She was married soon after her flight to another cosmonaut. She has a daughter who is now a physician, and she gradually became just another star in the firmament of Soviet society. And then when it became Russia, she's still a very adored person. And but if you someone I knew had been in at the launch pad not long ago, and there were some people there, you know, old-timers, and they said, oh, Tereshkova, she was just terrible. So the tradition has been in the Russian world of cosmonautics to say that women are not very good. And not long ago, I guess it was last year, the head of the Russian space agency at Star City announced that they would not train any more women astronauts, that cosmonauts. Women are not good at this. Space is for men. Mm. So their early effort to have a woman in space, which was as much for publicity as anything else, especially after the program wasn't really being encouraged after Korolev's death, has come, in a sense, full circle. Yeah. That they have become as anti-female as probably the society had been for a while, and as much akin to the way the United States was then, but is certainly not anymore.
How was her accomplishment seen in the U.S. by the media and by American women?
Well, that's very interesting, because in Russia, of course, she was a heroine, and Russian children, still little girls, want to grow up to be cosmonauts just like her. In the United States, most of the popular press made fun of her. They said only a Russian would be so cruel as to send up a woman. She was too fragile. Women are too fragile. This should not have been done. But there were a couple of people who defended the idea of sending a woman, and one was Claire Booth Luce, whose husband owned Life magazine. And she herself had been an ambassador, and she had been a playwright. That was a very well-known person in American society. And she said that the Russians are ahead of us on this, that it made sense to send up a woman. Women in America were being treated as dolls and didn't need to be treated that way, that women needed responsibility, and that we better kind of catch up with the Russians. This was an embarrassment. Mm.
Speaking of dolls, in 1965, Mattel introduced astronaut Barbie. And in 1966, Star Trek was on television. I also remember a television show from my childhood called Lost in Space. Were there signals beginning to appear in popular culture that America one day might train women to explore, work, and live in space?
Yes, it's kind of wonderful, isn't it, that popular culture was
way out ahead.
Oh, 15 years ahead of what was going to happen. That we even had Barbarella with Jane Fonda. I think that's 1967 or 8, where you have a woman in a spaceship by herself who looks a little bit like a stupid, dumb, sex kitten, but in fact, in the film, she is very smart, and the women are running things. So there were lots of flags out to show that American women and Western European women were going to be demanding some kind of attention. But it happened in our imaginations before it happened in the real world.
Any record of how the folks at NASA viewed these signposts?
The folks at NASA didn't see them. But NASA used to do lots of public opinion polling. And in the early 70s, when things were going bad for the space program, Apollo had closed down before they sent their last two flights. The public was much more interested in trying to take care of some of the problems in the States, and the Vietnam War was just, you know, winding down. And the space program seemed to be too rarefied, and certainly it didn't apply to women and people of color. And when they did these polls, they found that they had very little support among women and minority groups. So NASA decided they better do something about this. And they had trouble. It had already become an agency that was heavy with very traditional people who were not moving very fast. Most of the NASA stations were in the South. There was one or two in California, but you have the Johnson Space Center in Texas and the Kennedy Space Center in Florida and the Marshall Space Center in Alabama. And although the civil rights movement was moving along and there were requirements to hire women and hire people of color, it wasn't happening at NASA nearly as rapidly as it was happening everywhere else. So there were all sorts of problems that were happening. NASA was under fire from in Congress for not moving fast enough on these things. So finally, it was decided that they better that take women. And so they made announcements. And there were a lot of announcements that didn't pan out. There were several women, one at Ames in near Palo Alto in Mountain View, California, and women from the in Texas and in from the stationed in Alabama and Birmingham, who were given a lot of public attention in the news media that they were maybe going to be the first women astronauts. And they actually went as far as being tested at in Texas to see how well they did on the centrifuge, which turned out to be unnecessary. But that's the way they were looking at astronauts, was to see how they could stand nausea and perhaps the big change in gravity, because no one really knew how anybody was going to survive healthily in a long-term adventure in this strange realm of space. So it was hard. But they eventually decided that they better take a whole new kind of astronaut. And so the shuttle, which was a new vehicle, and was going to be ready, apparently. They thought it was going to be ready to fly in 1978 or 79. It first flew in 1982. But they took a new group of astronauts. And for the first time, they decided to take women. And that was because these women were not going to be pilots. They were going to be mission specialists, and men too. So there was a whole new group of astronauts who were not just pilots. Or you needed pilots. Of course, we still need pilots. The crowning breakthrough for women was when they finally did take a woman to be a pilot and then a commander, and that was Eileen Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And that showed that the last hurdle had been passed, that a woman could do anything at NASA that a man could do.
Hmm.
Although today, there's only one woman commander. They haven't taken any women pilots. There had been two others, and Eileen Collins has retired, and the other woman who was doing this had two flights and decided that for family reasons, she couldn't stay an astronaut. So we're left with Pamela Milroy, who was a fabulous human being as well as a great astronaut. But she's the only commander left in the Corps who is female. Hmm. And then you have lots of women who are doing other wonderful things. We have medical astronauts and scientist astronauts and engineering astronauts. And now we have a new group. They've been around for a while, but they haven't flown yet, of teacher astronauts.
Right. That one of the things that I did yesterday in preparation for talking with you this afternoon is to go to the NASA website and look at the launch schedule for 2007. And coming up in June of this year, there is going to be a launch planned anyway of Endeavour. And of the 8 astronauts on board, 3 will be women, and one of the 3 will be Barbara Morgan. And she was Krista McAuliffe's backup. Right. And she has had a long, think of all the years now since the Challenger accident. Did you talk with her for almost
half? I have talked with her. She's had a very interesting career. She is a teacher, and apparently a fabulous teacher. And she went down to work out to Houston, and became a very close friend of Krista's. Now, the interesting thing is that neither of them, neither Krista nor Barbara Morgan, were astronauts. They weren't trained as astronauts. They were given, I guess it was around 3 months where they were supposed to plan a tutorial or some kind of, not a tutorial, but some kind of educational program that they would do once they were, actually in space. But they weren't given the regular astronaut training. And then after Challenger, there was this kind of period of readjusting. And Barbara Morgan really wanted to go up in space. But this time, she applied to be an astronaut. And she was accepted into the astronaut program a few years later, and she has gone through the same astronaut training that Sally Ride has gone through, that every astronaut goes through, which is a very intense period of training. So she is an astronaut whose mission is to be an education astronaut. And then there are several more. 3 new astronauts in the class that came in 2004 are teacher astronauts. And 2 of them are women.
What led Barbara Morgan to decide that she wanted to go through the whole training, the astronaut training?
Well, I think it's that was there have been very few guest astronauts since Challenger. That no one was going to go up. There wasn't going to be a journalist astronaut. At the time of the teacher astronaut, there was lots of talk about having a journalist astronaut, maybe an artist astronaut, someone who would be a payload specialist, someone who would be there just for the one trip and who wouldn't be trained as an astronaut but would be trained in their specialty, which they would do when they were in space. Most of the payload specialists have been scientists who did their one spend a lot of time doing either biology or chemistry or physics experiments. But people talked about having a journalist, a poet, someone who would be able to come back and, speak in rapturous phrases about what it was like to be in space. But that was eliminated. The feeling was that you needed people who were trained professionally so that if there was a problem, astronauts were trained to take over each other's jobs. You could have someone who was helping with the payload or helping with the arm. They have this huge mechanical arm. There are all sorts of things that astronauts do. And the more versatile an astronaut is, the more usable they are in a crew. So that this astronaut, the teacher astronaut, would really be able to do everything else as well.
Mm. Let's talk with the listener now. Listener in Urbana, on line 1. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a fascinating program. Who were the teachers planning to teach other astronauts or the general public?
Only the general public.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They were supposed to be interviewed from space and with, you know, probably with video, and they would perhaps show how different items move in zero gravity, maybe some experiments, maybe a view from the window. I'm not sure what each one, and we don't know what Krista McCullough was going to do because she never, there was no record left of her plans.
Oh, right. So then we'll have to wait and see what
Barbara Morgan.
Yes, we'll have to wait and see how she teaches us, huh?
Well, she's to read about her experiences and to talk to her as a teacher. She seems to be phenomenal. She had spent time early in her career teaching on Indians and Indian reservations. She'd been to Latin America and done teaching in small schools there. And she'd had a regular class in her hometown. I can't remember exactly where it is, but I think it's in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. So she is an extremely experienced teacher and much admired and loved by her students.
Okay, well, we'll see. It will be interesting to see her up in space if all goes well. Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. How does Barbara Morgan think about the risks, the dangers that space flight entails?
I think all of the astronauts, whether they're teachers or whether they're physicists or pilots, know that there is risk involved. And they all feel that there's risk involved in many things in life, and that this is an instance where the risk is worth the advantages of actually being up there and doing what you want to do.
Mm. Today, we've talked a little bit about NASA and its relationship with the military. Today, the military relies heavily on women, and it has become much more open to women in leadership. How has that affected NASA?
Now NASA has kept to a proportion of around 20 to 25% women, which, of course, is less than the general population, but is keeping well within the numbers of women who are getting PhDs in sciences. Not in medicine. More than 50% of our doctors are now, graduating doctors, are female. So NASA is not as equal in terms of gender as the rest of, as parts of society. But in society, as a society as a whole, NASA is doing pretty well. Women, though, who are going up on flights, there are going to be three women in the next flight. There have been usually two on most flights recently. There was one on the last flight. But the really interesting thing is women are now doing everything. Women are doing the heavy work. They're going out and doing spacewalks, which takes a great deal of muscle power in your torso. These are roles that there have been women who did spacewalks before. Kathy Sullivan was the first woman. Catherine Thornton also did a lot of heavy work. But these were unusual. Most of the women have not been going outside into space. Now women are doing just about everything that male astronauts are doing.
Hmm. And they're loving it?
Oh, of course. I've never I've never met an astronaut who didn't want to go back. Yeah. They all love it. There are all sorts of reasons for loving it. After the first flight, you spent a lot of time just kind of finding it unbelievable how remarkable the view is. And getting used to being in zero gravity and seeing what your body can do when there's no gravity. And these are wonderful sensations. I've never heard of anybody who didn't think this was wonderful. And then you just get used to it, and you find you can do more of everything. If you're a scientist, you can enjoy. You can do things in the laboratory you have there. And if you're helping to actually build the shuttle, which many people have been doing, because most of their flights lately have been to complete the construction of the space station. Well, the space station is a giant enterprise, the most extraordinary thing probably since the pyramids. the ambition to do this, to create this very large working laboratory, platform, place in space. And women are doing that, and they're doing all the heavy work. Of course, the work isn't heavy. When you're carrying something that would be, you know, thousands of pounds in gravity, it's not in space. But it's still awkward. You're still carrying big things.
Yeah.
So, and women have been doing all this.
Yeah.
But we all know, I think, by this time, that there are a lot of women carpenters and women who are doing putting in radio towers and telephones and line people. Women doing every kind of job are now permeating our society. So we're used to it, and we don't, most people don't say, oh, you know, a woman doctor or, you know, a woman engineer. No, we're used to it.
Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Betty Ann Holtzman-Kevlis, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
Betty Ann Kevlis is the author of Almost Heaven, The Story of Women in Space. It is available in paperback from the MIT Press. It is a very good read. And Betty Ann Kevlis joined us this afternoon from Yale, where she teaches in the Department of History at Yale University. And our thanks this afternoon to Yale and to the technical director there in the studios at Yale, Bill Kearney.